For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. Now, Christian friends, it should be fairly familiar what I'm going to say next. If you remember the flesh, the age that is passing is ruled by sin. It's heading for death. The spirit is the age that is coming and has already begun. It's marked by obedience. It leads to life, life which has already begun. So flesh, spirit, sin, obedience, death, life. And when we're converted, we cross the floor. We leave the realm of the flesh for the realm of the spirit. And the change is real. It's definitive. It's decisive. We are no longer ruled by sin. Our obedience may not be perfect obedience, but our obedience is nevertheless real obedience. And in Jesus' words, we have passed from death to life. I'm not what I once was. However, as Paul's been explaining to us, neither am I yet what I shall be. I now live by the Spirit, but of course I'm still in the body of flesh. I experience the realities of the age to come, but I'm still living in this present evil age. I belong to the new creation while still existing in the old creation. I'm a child of God, but I must endure suffering and death. I'm an heir of God, but I've yet to come of age. Now, last time we spoke of Bunyan's picture of passion and patience. Do you remember two small boys? The older one is called passion, the younger one is called patience. And if you remember, passion is discontent, and patience just sits there very quietly. Well, to passion, if you remember, is given this great big bag of treasure. It's poured out at his feet, and he is thrilled. And he looks sideways at patience, and he laughs. Laughs at patience for being such a loser, for going without. But of course, in a very short time, passion wastes his treasure and is left with nothing. Now, Christian friends, passion is the life of the flesh. It's this world, my sin. It's me first. That's the language, me first. What about me? But it ends up with nothing. Verse 13, for if you live according to the flesh, you will die. Patience is the life of the Spirit. It's that world. It's obedience to my Heavenly Father. And all the talk is not of me, the talk is of Him, Jesus first. Which is why patience is happy to go without now. Because of the inheritance that is awaiting him. So says Paul, verse 15, for you did not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you've received the spirit of adoption as sons by whom we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs. Heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with him in order that we may also be glorified with him. Says the apostle, we can go without now. We're not jealous of passion now. We haven't got our eyes on his bag of treasure and thinking, what about me? I'm missing out. Because we have our eyes upon glory. Glory awaits. Because as Jesus said, the last shall be first and the first shall be last. It's the meek that inherit the earth. We wait for our coming of age, which is where Paul now turns. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. Now, when Paul says that, just for a moment, think of Paul's life. And think of his life in terms of a set of scales. And on this side, we're going to put the sufferings of this present time. And we get a glimpse of them, particularly in Paul's letter of 2 Corinthians. It's his most personal letter, and he speaks about the things he's had to go through. And particularly chapters 11 and 12, and you can read the list. It speaks of imprisonments and beatings, sometimes to within an inch of his life. There are scourgings, stonings, shipwrecks. He's a man in constant danger. There's danger from robbers, from Jews, from Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the countryside, dangers at sea, dangers everywhere, he says. And dangers from false brothers, those who pretend friendship and then stick the knife in the back. He goes on and speaks about toil, hardship, exhaustion, sleepless nights, hunger, thirst, cold, nakedness. And perhaps worse than all of those things is Paul, but this constant anxiety I have for the churches. That just seems to bear down upon me, a yoke that's been placed on my shoulders, the apostle to the Gentiles, my churches, how is it with them? And then adds all this, this thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan. And believe it or not, when you look at Paul, he has to also endure the unfriendliness and the suspicions of God's people. Isn't that dreadful? He didn't enjoy the confidence of many of God's people. Which is why in his last letter to Timothy, we find him abandoned. The believers that should stand with him won't stand with him. They keep their distance from Paul. He's the abandoned apostle. No one stood with me, he said, except the Lord. And then he's put to death. You think, well, what was all that about? No wonder passion laughs. It's a life of pain, humiliation, rejection, death. Paul the loser. And you look at it on the other side, well, this is so heavy, Paul. Is it? Says the apostle, for I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. It's not this side that weighs down upon me, says Paul. It's this side. It doesn't just tip the balance. It swings it all round. Because what are the sufferings of a few years compared to eternal glory? And if I compare, says Paul, now with then, the sufferings with the glory, there is no comparison. It's never been a better time to give up all for Jesus, to suffer with him, provided we suffer with him in order that we may also be glorified with him. Because these temporary, transitory sufferings, where do they lead? They lead to eternal glory. And says the apostle, I'm happy to wait for that. Okay, Paul, well, tell us about this glory. What is it that so weighs the balance the other way? And so today we're going to look at verses 18 to 25. It's not the full, Paul will go on to talk about more of the glory, but we're only going to get to verse 25 today. So please have those verses in front of you. Romans 8, verses 18 to 25. We have three things to say. Speaking of the glory that awaits. And the first thing is this, a glorified creation. Verse 19, for the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope, that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. Now, if you notice that, what Paul says, he says, our future as God's people and the future of the creation are bound up together. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected in hope, that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. The future of the creation is bound up with the future of God's people. So here's a play. But on the opening night, the lead actor, the principal actor, falls ill. And so the rest of the cast think to themselves, well, all that rehearsal, all that getting ready, that was a waste of time. Maybe now the play will never go ahead. Maybe no one will ever see what we had planned. Adam was made to reign. He was made to rule over the works of God's hands. He was God's chosen king. And he was born to reign over God's creation. In other words, Adam was that principal actor. And so when Adam sinned, when he fell, the whole creation with him was cursed. Verse 20, for the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly. It's not what the creation would have chosen. It wasn't what it wanted to be. The play was ready. Everything was ready. But there was no opening night. The creation cannot fulfill its destiny. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it. It's what God himself did to the creation. It was God himself who called off the play. He put creation under a curse when man fell. But of course, that's not the end of the story, because Paul says, for the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Creation is looking forward. Paul's personifying creation, isn't he? It's looking forward to the day when it will be restored. It's looking forward to the day when the play will go ahead. And when will that be? It will be with the restoration of the lead actor. And so, verse 90, when the sons of God are revealed. When, verse 21, the children of God come of age, when they're glorified. Then, verse 21, the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption to obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. It will be a restored, regenerated, resurrected, new creation. Verse 22, for we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. See, creation is longing to be free from its slavery. It's what Paul calls its slavery to corruption. Can you hear creation groaning? If only the world was full of kittens. But kittens grow up to bite and scratch and kill. If only the world was filled with bunny rabbits. But rabbits scream when foxes kill them. And if you leave them to breed unchecked, they will turn your green and pleasant land into a wasteland. If only the world was filled with songbirds. But a nesting pair will raise a brood of seven, and by next spring, six of those seven will have died. And one of the adults would have died. Do you see? For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. The creation groans like a woman in labor. And sometimes those birth pangs are unbearable. Creation screams. But just as labor is not the end, it brings forth a child, so says Paul, this present groaning of the creation is not the end. This creation will give birth. Give birth to a new creation. The sweat free of the curse. And it can't wait. Verse 19, for the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. The sense of it is that creation is on tiptoes, craning its neck, eager longing, waiting for the day when the sons of God come of age, and then the play can begin. And on that day, slavery will give way to freedom, and corruption will make way for glory, and all the frustration will be overtaken by fulfillment. On that day when man again is seated at God's right hand to rule over the works of his hands, the way it was always meant to be. a glorified creation. Okay, Paul, this the glory that awaits, what else? Well, he says a glorified body, point number two. Verse 22, for we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in pains of childbirth until now, and not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for the adoption, for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. Now, Christian friends, we live in what sometimes has been called the already but not yet. I'm already God's child, but I've not yet come of age. I've not yet reached my 18th birthday. I'm already God's heir, but I've not yet received my full inheritance. I'm already indwelt by God's Spirit, but of course I'm still living in the old body, this body of flesh. I already have the first fruits of the Spirit, but we long for full harvest, what Paul calls the redemption of our bodies. We live in the already, but not yet. Which is why there's this mismatch, this tension that we feel. Explain what I mean. Let's talk about clothing. Why does a woman wear a white dress? Because she's the bride and it's her wedding day. Her clothing tells you what she is, who she is. You see her white dress and she's instantly recognizable as a bride. Why does a policeman wear a blue uniform? Because he's an on-duty policeman. And his clothing tells you who he is. I need to see where, as a policeman, I can go and speak to him. In other words, our clothing carries a message. Our clothing reflects who we are. Now, when the Bible talks about our bodies, it talks about them as clothing. So when you think about clothing, it applies to our bodies. Well, what does my present clothing, what does this present body reveal about me? Well, if I look at my present body, I'm instantly recognizable as a sinner. It's a body of death because the wages of sin is death. It's a body of humiliation because we've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And it's a body of corruption. All of us feel ashamed about the way that we look. That's why we're wearing clothes. That's why we don't want people to see the way that we look. And it's a reminder that I'm naked and guilty before God, and I've got things to hide. There are things about me I don't want him to see. My present clothing, this present body, reveals that I'm a condemned sinner. And yet, what do we read? Chapter 8, verse 1, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And verse 9, you whoever are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit. Verse 15, for you did not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you've received the spirit of adoption, by whom we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. So do you see, we're uncondemned children of God, filled with the Spirit of God. Which means I've got the wrong clothes on, doesn't it? If my clothes say I'm a condemned sinner, but I'm not a condemned sinner. If my clothes are saying, look, God is angry with you and you're lost, but I'm not in that situation anymore, am I? I'm God's son, I'm God's child. He indwells me by his Spirit. There's a mismatch. I've got the wrong clothes on. In other words, we're kings, but we're dressed in rags. We're clean, but we're filthy. We're wearing filthy clothes. We're sons of God, but we're in the garb of condemned sinners. And it's not fancy dress. We feel it, says Paul. We groan. I'm a new person, but my body remains the same. Verse 23, not the creation, not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. Now, as we get older, we do groan. I think it's when you get to about 40 or something, isn't it? You, when you, when you start sitting in a chair, it's like, oh. And then you've got to get out of the chair, it's like, oh. And as you get older, you make more and more noise. But Paul's not talking about the outward noise. He's talking about, he says, an inward groaning. All right? So he's not just talking about the fact we get older, we start creaking. It's an inward groaning. It's this mismatch between what I am on the inside and the clothes I have to wear on the outside. The mismatch between what I have become and the clothes that I'm still wearing. And that groaning is telling you something. It's saying, actually, even though I may not always verbalize it like this, or even necessarily stop and think of it like this, what this groaning I feel inside is, I can't wait to get out of these filthy rags and into our wedding clothes, our resurrection bodies. We ourselves, we groan. We have the first fruits of the Spirit. We groan inwardly as we wait eagerly as sons for the redemption of our bodies. Says the Apostle, we have the first fruits of the Spirit. Okay, it's the Feast of Pentecost. It was the Feast of the First Fruits. It was the feast to look forward to the full harvest. We have the first fruits of the Spirit. But it's only the first fruits. We wait eagerly for the full harvest, the redemption of our bodies, when there will be no more disease and dysfunction and death, and no more suffering, shame, sin, and no more distance. You know, our bodies don't obey us, do they? They're all the time thwarting us, frustrating us. I pull a lever with my body here and something else happens over there. There's this dislocation between what I want to do for Jesus and what I actually end up doing for Jesus. Because either I'm too tired or I'm distracted or something happened. And no more boarding school. It'll be the summer holidays. And I shall go home to my Father's house. And no more coming and going of our beloved. It'll be our wedding day. It'll be the full harvest. Our coming of age as the children of God. The redemption of our bodies. So a glorified creation, a glorified body. Well, point number three, let's bring it all together. Excuse me. Let's bring it all together. Christian friends, our resurrection body. C.S. Lewis thinks of it in these terms. He says, like at the end of the day, after a hard day's work, and what do? You're filthy, you're sweaty, and you strip off, don't you, that old, sweaty, filthy, dirty shirt, and you step into the shower. Because, friends, the day is coming when we'll strip off these shameful, ugly, soiled bodies. We'll strip off this old corruption, this old mortality. And we'll be clothed with glorious, incorruptible resurrection bodies. And then, on that day, there'll be no mismatch. Then we will appear as we truly are, the children of God. Look at verse 19. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. Now, you look at a group photograph. Can you tell just by looking at that photograph who is and who isn't a Christian? No, you can't tell, can you? Unless it's holding up something. You can't tell because everyone's wearing old clothes. Everyone's wearing this mortality. There's nothing recognizably in my appearance that says I'm a Christian. But on that day, we will have glorious bodies which truly reflect who we are, the children of God. Bodies that reflect the glory of God himself. I like the New King James translation of verse 18. It talks about, for I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed in us. The glory will be revealed in us. Christian friend, in Jesus' words, the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. And angels will look into our faces and they will fall back as they see the beauty of holiness. In us will be the restored image of God. And therefore, if a restored image of God, we will look like God. We will be the finite reflections of the infinite God. We will shine with the glory of God. We will shine like the sun in the kingdom of our Father. As the sun mirrors the Father, so the church, the bride, will mirror the sun. And he'll be ravished at the sight of us. Psalm 45, so the king will greatly desire your beauty. John says we shall be like him. Think about that. We should be like Christ. We'll perhaps next time talk more about this. But on that resurrection Sunday, you remember the disciples are meeting behind closed doors. And yet without footfall or shadow, Jesus suddenly is standing among them. How did he get in? The doors are locked. How did he get standing among them? No one heard him come, and yet he's here. How did he do it? Well, he can walk through walls. And of course, the terrified disciples think it's a ghost. And so he says to them, does a spirit have flesh and bone as I have? One writer puts it like this. He says, when Christ rose, he rose in the flesh. He was no ghost. And yet he walked through walls. The walls are the ghosts. And so are we. Do you see? That's the real body. That's the real flesh. It's these bodies that are the ghosts. These are the temporary, fading, transient, fleshly bodies. But on that day we shall be like him. Real bodies for the real world. Eternal bodies made for eternal glory. And of course, the redemption of our bodies will mark the redemption of the creation. For the creation waits with eager longing. It's standing on its tiptoes. It's craning its neck for the revealing of the sons of God. Verse 21, the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption, free from the curse, and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. You see, with the restoration of the lead actor, the great story can begin. And the creation will be freed from its slavery to corruption. In other words, the shackles will be off. Now, Christian friend, have you ever had those moments when you felt creation stir? You know, maybe it's a beautiful setting. You're sitting there watching, thinking, just taking, drinking it all in. And there's something inside you which feels that it's glorious, but it's capable of something altogether more glorious. Sometimes you can't quite put your finger on it, but there's that sense that it's capable of something more, but it can't break free. It's under the curse. It's been subjected to futility. In Prince Caspian, Lucy remembers the days when the trees could talk. She says to them, oh trees, wake. And though there was not a breath of wind, they all stirred about her. The rustling noise of the leaves was almost like words. The nightingale stopped singing to listen to it. Lucy felt at any moment she would begin to understand what the trees were trying to say. But the moment didn't come. The rustling died away. The nightingale resumed its song. That's only a story. But somehow it's not strange, is it? You see, we were created to rule over the works of God's hands. We were created for the creation to move and stir at our voice. But it doesn't. It's in bondage. It's under the curse. And yet, verse 19, it waits with eager longing. Wait for that day when the chains will be broken and it will be free. And again it hears the voices and the laughter of the children of God. Isaiah puts it like this, for you will go out with joy and be led forth with peace, and the mountains and the hills will break forth into singing before you, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. And who's to say when the mountains sing, it won't be real singing? And when the trees clap their hands, it won't be real clapping. The creation is thrown off the curse. The shackles have gone. It's alive, it lives, it pulses, it sings. Now the great play can begin. It can fulfill what it was always meant to be. What do you love about this creation? I mean the one we're in now. It's got the freshness after a storm. Or maybe just the crashing of the waves and you're near enough and you taste your lips and they're got salt all over them. Or the danger of the edge. That's exciting, isn't it? Or the magic of a snowfall. The beauty of a rainbow. The majesty of a lion. The power of a horse. The cheeriness of a budgie. The brush of a butterfly's wing. Or just the sheer bonkers of a walrus. If we love these things in this creation, how much more in that creation when the shackles are off? And this creation compared to that creation, well, this creation just looked like an old faded black and white photograph. And that won't be the photograph, that'll be the 3D, the real thing. And of course it'll be the creation that's under our feet, verse 21. The creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. Remember, its future is bound up with our future. Now, have you a dog? It's not wild, is it? It doesn't run with the pack. At times you think your dog is almost human. And that's because under your headship, it does reflect something of your image. It's been humanized. It's under your feet. That's why your dog is like it is. It's under your feet. It's been humanized. But on that day, the whole creation will be under our feet. And will bear our image. And we will reign over it. Isaiah again. This is what he says. Talking of that day when we rule over the creation, the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, and the calf of the lion and the fatted calf together, and a little child shall lead them. See? Even a little child can lead the leopard and the lion. The cow and the bear shall graze, the young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of a cobra, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. But don't misunderstand. Creation won't be Disneyfied. The lions won't be cute, because if they were cute, they'd cease to be lions. In that world, they're the real lions. You think you've seen a lion now. You wait till you see those lions. Awesome, majestic, fierce. Then we'll understand why God likens himself sometimes to a lion. But they'll be under our feet. Resurrection bodies in a resurrected universe. And Christian friends, on that day, with our real eyes, these are just the copies. These are just the fading images. With our real eyes, we shall gaze upon the real world. And when we contrast now with them, we'll think we've never ever seen before. And with our real ears, we'll listen to the voice of creation. We'll listen to the singing. Groaning's going to be replaced by singing. The hills will break forth into song. And compared to now, we'll think we've never heard anything before. And who knows in those new bodies what new senses we will be given, what new gifts we have. Who knows what new dimensions the creation will possess. The chains will be broken. We'll run and not grow weary. And the shivering sparrows will mount up on wings like eagles. What new horizons will lie before us? And on that day, hope will give way to sight. And of course, that's just the beginning. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with him in order that we may also be glorified with him. And on that day, the Father will say, all that is mine is yours to enjoy with my Son. As we close, look at verse 24. For in this hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what he sees? In this hope you were saved. Christian friends, when we were saved, this was always the plan. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish. But what? But have everlasting life. Not existence. Who wants everlasting existence? Who wants the drudgery of just existing? This is life. Eternal glory. And when you were saved, that was always the plan. And maybe this boy, you didn't realize just how big the plan is. For in this hope we were saved. Now, hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. A glorified body, a glorified universe. But says Paul, it's yet to be. Then is not now. If then was now, you wouldn't have to wait for it, would you? Hope wouldn't be hope, because if then was now, you wouldn't be waiting. It would be here. Now, hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope, and if you remember, the Bible word for hope is not, well, I hope it works out okay. It's a confident expectation. If we hope, if we live in confident expectation of what will be, if we take to heart the promise of God, if you like, if we wait to our 18th birthday, our coming of age, then, says the apostle, you won't be jealous of passion's big bag of treasure. We won't feel we're missing out. We won't feel we're being left behind. We won't feel that Christian life is costing me too much. On the contrary, we'll wait with patience, with eager expectation, with the assurance, the confidence that the best is yet to be. But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. So, Christian friend, are you waiting? Do you go to bed at night thinking a day's march nearer home? Do you? Do you think I'm much closer now to that than I was when I first believed? Will you feel at the end of this Lord's Day, I don't know how many more Lord's Days I've got left. How many more stepping stones to get across the wilderness? Are you waiting? Have you got your head up? If it's your hope, you're looking up to it, aren't you? Not looking at your feet. Are you gazing at your navel, looking at your feet, or are you looking up? Our redemption draws near. And therefore, if that is what is awaiting us, are you up and doing for Jesus now? Are you laying up treasure in heaven? For where your treasure is, says Jesus, there your heart will be also. As you probably know, Mandy grew up in a rough part of town. And when she was a little girl, she'd lie in the wintertime, she'd lie in her freezing room under a thin blanket. But on this night, she didn't mind. It was Christmas Eve. And she knew that in a little while, her dad would steal into her room with her Christmas presents. She was so excited, so confident of his appearing, so sure of the wonder of those presents, that the wait in that dark, cold, shabby room seemed like nothing. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us.